We found in Genesis 3 that the effect of the curse on women is that women try to dominate their husbands through manipulation, and they end up being dominated by their husbands through harshness. And so the solution to that for wives is respect, and that's demonstrated in a number of ways. Respect can be demonstrated through submission or the way that they speak to their husbands and so on. The solution for husbands is what we want to address this morning. We talked last week about submission. This week we're going to talk about what the Bible says about husbands. And the solution for husbands is to love their wives and not be harsh with them. Every time we see an instruction to husbands, it's always the same thing. Love your wives. 5 men came up to me last week after the sermon and said, you know, that's the best sermon I've ever heard you preach. The sermon on wives to be submissive to your husband. No women said anything. You know, actually, the wives, the stuff last week is mostly focused toward the ladies, and then this stuff here is for the men. So keep that in mind, because we can forget about ever solving our marriage problem. And seriously, we can forget about ever solving the problems that we have in marriage as long as we're focused on what our spouse is supposed to be doing. That'll never work. Now, husbands, love your wives. You might have expected something different from that. You might have expected, after our study of Genesis 2, for it to say, husbands, lead your wives and protect. Or, since it always says, wives, submit, you might expect, wives, submit, husbands, rule. Wives, take orders, husbands, give orders, or something like that. It's not what it says. It says, even though that we found in Genesis 2 that the primary role of a man is to lead and protect and provide for, we don't see in the New Testament a big emphasis on husbands lead. Rather, we see the bigger emphasis on husbands love. Why is that? Why does it say husbands love your wives and do not be harsh with them? The reason is because if a man genuinely loves his wife, he will tend to do the other things, lead and to do the things that he needs to do. But as always, just as everything in the New Testament, God does not want us to focus our attention on the procedure. He wants us to focus our attention on what? The attitude. That's why the primary summary for the women last week, remember, was not submit, but rather respect. Remember Ephesians 5:33? And for the men, it's an attitude as well. It's not a procedure, but an attitude. And the attitude is love. You could carry out all of your duties of leading and protecting, all that stuff, without loving her, and you would be falling far short of your duty. You probably studied this term love. The word is agape in the Greek. If you've studied that at all, you've found that it involves the will as much as it is an act of the emotion. Agape is self-sacrificial service for someone else's benefit. It's servanthood. As the highest authority in the home, men, it is your responsibility to be the greatest servant. Jesus couldn't have possibly made that more clear. If someone walked into your home, just ask yourself, would it be immediately obvious to them that you are the greatest servant there? Whenever you talk about self-sacrifice, people are always quick to say, yes, self-sacrifice, we need to have self-sacrificial love, but we don't want to become a doormat. I mean, you don't want to be a doormat. And that just seems to have universal acceptance. Don't be a doormat. Let me ask you a question. What is a doormat? What is the purpose of a doormat? The reason we don't want to be a doormat is because to be a doormat is the most humiliating thing, because a doormat is something that people come and wipe the mud and dirt off their feet with it. Let me ask you this. What is the first century equivalent to a doormat? A foot washer. In their day, when they talked about servanthood, they probably said positive things about servanthood. Yeah, we should be servants, but we don't want to be, it'll go too far and be a foot washer. But when Jesus was teaching about leadership, what did he become? A human doormat. Literally. Jesus' standard was always so far beyond what we think to be reasonable limits. You know, we understand Jesus' standards, but we want to set reasonable limits on them, because otherwise it's just too much. And when he gave examples, the examples were always so far exceeded what we think of as reasonable limits. I mean, how far are we to take this? Yeah, sure, you're supposed to serve your wife. Sure, you're supposed to lay down your life for your wife. But, I mean, where's the reasonable limitation to that? Where do we draw the line? In Jesus' day, Israel was occupied by their most hated enemy, Rome. And if you can imagine that happening to us today, if you can imagine being occupied by the Taliban government, if we were conquered by them and taken over and occupied, or Nazi Germany or something like that, World War II. one of the rules they had for the Roman soldiers then is if a Roman soldier came up to a Jew, at any time, he could just say, here, carry my pack and all my gear for a mile. And you had to just drop whatever you're doing and walk a mile with him, carry all his stuff. Then you had to walk a mile back to where you started from, and then you go, can you imagine what that was like? You're on your way to an important meeting or some, on your way to church or something, you're on your way to work, and then all of a sudden you have to just take this time to go for and walk a mile carrying this hated soldier's pack. I was listening this week to a sermon, and I heard somebody talking about this very point. And I just sat back and I thought to myself, you know, what a great principle that is. Because you know what Jesus said. They wanted to know, people wanted to know what Jesus would think of that. They hated that. It was very oppressive to them. And so Jesus, they said, Jesus, what should we do? And Jesus said, you know, if that happens to you, if you get a soldier comes up, says, carry my pack for a mile, here's what you should do. Carry his pack for a mile. And then when you get done with that mile, you turn to the soldier and say, you know what, I would like to carry your pack another mile. That's Jesus' standard. Way beyond what people would expect. Well, I was listening to the sermon, I was thinking that thing, you know, I was almost thinking, you know, I wish I lived back then. What a great thing to do. What a great witness that would be. What an impact you could have on a soldier, a Roman soldier, by being willing to do that. And I just was thinking about how, you know, it'd be a great thing. And yeah, you could, the whole second mile, you could explain to him why, you know, and so I was just thinking, I almost wish I was there so I could do that. Imagining that I would be perfectly willing, of course, to do it. So on. And, you know, we tend to think that. We tend to think the people in the first century didn't have anything else to do besides walk around as a soldier. You know, they didn't have important meetings to be at. And they, you know, they just sat around all day. Of course, they were probably more busy than us. They had to work all day just to eat. If you don't think that would bother you to carry somebody's pack for a mile, just think about how you feel if something happens while you're in Walmart and you have to end up standing in line for an extra 15 minutes. How flustered we get over that. You can imagine having to walk 2 extra miles. Anyway, so I'm sitting there thinking about how willing I would be to do this, and suddenly it just hits me like a ton of bricks. The Holy Spirit, who convicts of sin and applies principles to our heart, applied this principle to my heart. And all of a sudden I realized what this meant for me. You see, one of my pet peeves used to be when Tracy and I would get in bed at night, we'd lay down, and Tracy would begin searching her mind to see if she could think of anything that was wrong, that needed to be corrected. And there was something of, I don't know what it was. It was she would never think that way before we got down to bed, only after we lay down in bed. She would, you know, as soon as we would lay down, and we'd be comfortable in bed, all of a sudden we're laying there and suddenly, is the basement light turned off? Is the garage door closed? You know, is the garbage out to the curb? Is the dome light on in the car? Is, you know, and she'd just think of all this stuff. And inevitably, she'd finally think of something that wasn't done, needed doing, and I'd end up getting out of bed and taking care of that. It just drove me crazy. We finally took care of that. We developed a checklist to go over before we ever laid down in bed. And so that's all taken care of now. But it used to drive me crazy. And to my shame, I have to admit, there were some times when I would just lay there and say, you know, I don't even care if the garage door is open. I'll run the risk of having someone steal something. We're just going to leave it open tonight. Let's just go to sleep. Knowing full well that she wouldn't be able to go to sleep. Sooner or later, she'd get up and go and shut the garage door herself. So, it was almost as if the Lord was saying to me as I was hearing the sermon, picture this. You're laying in bed, almost asleep, perfectly comfortable, thinking about how important it is that you get a full night's rest because you have to, you know, I have to get a lot of rest because if I'm sleepy during the day and I try and study the Bible, I can't concentrate, so I have to get enough rest. So I'm sitting there thinking, I got to get enough rest, and I'm almost asleep, and all of a sudden, Tracy says something like, well, you know, the garbage man comes tomorrow morning. Is the garbage out to the curb? And so I get up, out of bed, take the trashes around the house, go and empty them into the garbage in the garage, open the door, take the thing out to the curb. I have a choice. I can do that with a bad attitude. You know, I can get out to the curb, slam the, you know, lid down, and march in, slam the door, whatever, and be grumpy when I get back in bed or whatever. Or I can do it with a good attitude. I can rejoice at this opportunity to serve my wife in this way and get up. And as soon as I get up, close the door, bedroom door, so I don't disturb her and take all the garbage out and, you know, take care of that whole thing. Do it with a happy attitude. Come back into the bedroom and give her a gentle kiss on the forehead just so she knows, you know, that I'm not upset in any way and she can go to sleep. And I can do it with a good attitude. So suppose I do the second choice. I take the second route, and I do it with a good attitude, and I do all that, and I just recognize this as a privilege, a way to serve my wife, and then I come back in the bedroom, and I do all that, and I'm walking back around the bed to my side, and imagine that I, on the way, I bump into Jesus who's standing there, and he says, "Okay, good job. Mile one, completed." And then I was thinking, what is mile two? And I realized, boy, I thought I was willing to do mile two. I'm having a tough time just being willing to do mile one. What is mile two? I don't know what mile two is for you in your situation. It can be a different thing in different circumstances, but the point of all that is when God talks about love, and he uses this word agape love, and he says, love your wives, Christ loved the church, that, listen, mile two type love, that's commanded of everybody, every Christian. But people in leadership are called to an even greater standard of self-sacrificial love. So something beyond mile two, mile three or four. I'd just like to suggest to you this morning that perhaps whatever the reasonable limits that we've set on serving our wives may be dramatically low in comparison with what it really means to love your wife as Christ loved the church. So love requires sacrifice, requires giving. It's an act of the will, and we all understand that. But as much as we emphasize that all the time, we should also recognize this. Love is not just an act of the will. It also does involve emotion. If Christ would have wanted to say, husbands, serve your wives, he could have said that. There is a Greek word for serve. He could have just said, husbands, serve your wives, and had that be the big emphasis. Instead, he says, husbands, love your wives. Because there's more to it than just a decision to serve. We need to really love them. A man is to delight in his wife, to take delight in her. Now, I think it's significant that in Genesis 2, we see Adam taking great delight in Eve, and yet we don't see a word about Eve taking any delight in Adam. Now, I think they probably delighted in each other, and I'm sure Eve enjoyed Adam and before the fall, and everything was great, but it's interesting to me, and I think significant, that Scripture mentions the fact that Adam delighted in her, but not vice versa. And I think that fits the way God made us. Generally speaking, I think a man tends to enjoy delighting in the woman he loves. And a woman tends, in general, generally speaking, to enjoy being delighted in by the man she loves. Men enjoy the beauty of women, and women tend to enjoy being beautiful. And some feminists have misunderstood this a little bit. They think of this as demeaning. You know, they think, well, yeah, I'm not going to put on lipstick, curl my hair, and, you know, do all that just to please some man. I mean, why should I slavishly have to primp myself just to bring some pleasure to some man somewhere? But you see, the point of this is not so that a man primarily can be delighted in taking pleasure in his wife's beauty. That's not the main point. And the main point isn't so that the woman can enjoy being delighted in by her husband. The main point is the marriage relationship is designed to reflect the relationship between Christ and the church, between God and His holy people. And that's the best reflection. That's the best picture. Because God takes delight in us, and we delight in delighting Him, in pleasing Him, in being pleasing to Him. I mean, of course, we want to take delight in Him and please Him, but primarily, He tends to delight in us, and we tend to delight mostly in being pleasing to Him. In the marriage relationship, the woman takes her cues from the church and the church's relationship to Christ. And the man takes his cues from Christ in Christ's relationship to the church. And so, Christ loved the church, and so men must treasure and love their wives. Now turn to Proverbs chapter 5. The thing that I want to show you, men, is that this is your responsibility, not hers. It's your responsibility to take delight in her. Some men don't delight in their wives. They just don't delight in their wives, and they think that it's their wives' fault. They think that it's her responsibility to make herself so delightful that, you know, he can't hardly help taking delight in her. But that's the opposite of what the Bible says. In the marriage relationship, men are to take their cues from Christ. Now, ask yourself, did Christ do that? Did Christ wait around until the church was irresistibly beautiful before he began to pursue her? Doesn't Romans 5:8 say, while we were yet sinners, he died for us? When we were his enemies, we were reconciled to him? He poured out his greatest, most profuse the expression of love to us at the moment, the very moment when we were at our ugliest. He pursued us while we were rejecting Him. He took initiative. And that's the man's example. It's the man's role to delight himself in his wife. Look at Proverbs 5:18. He says, "May your fountain be blessed, and may you rejoice in the wife of your youth. A loving doe, a graceful deer, may her breast satisfy you always, and may you ever be captivated by her love." Now, those verses are in the form of a blessing, but they appear in the context of a command. The point is, he's saying there, don't take pleasure in any other woman, find it in your wife. And that's a command. Notice what it doesn't say. It does not say, wives, be satisfying and captivating to your husbands. Now, 1 Corinthians 7 does say something like that, gets close to that. So there is some, wives should make some effort there. But regardless of what your wife does, absolutely regardless of what she does, we're commanded here, it's incumbent upon you, men, to be captivated by your wife's love. And the word captivated is a very strong term. It's a funny term. It's the only place in the Bible it's ever used in a positive sense. It means to stumble around or wander around drunk. The idea is just to be intoxicated with love. And the crucial point is this, guys. She shouldn't have to earn it. Remember when you felt like standing up and clapping last week when I said that the wives respect your husbands and they shouldn't have to earn it, regardless of whether they deserve respect, you need to respect your husband. It's the same way for your wife. You should delight in her. It's your responsibility to figure out a way to be intoxicated with your wife. God commands that, and He commands it knowing full well that your wife is not perfect. Knowing full well that you have a wife who has flaws. And yet He commands this. Just like your wife is required to respect and honor you, regardless of what you're like. Regardless of whether or not you deserve it. Just because of your position. You may have taught that to your kids. You may have said, kids, respect your authorities, your teacher at school, just because of the position. You respect the position. It's the same way with your wife. You love and delight in her because of her position as your wife. She shouldn't have to earn it. And you might think, isn't delighting in something out of my control? I mean, how can I help it? I mean, some people like peas and some people don't. And if you don't like them, how can you make yourself like it? I mean, how can you just change your desires and what you enjoy and what you like, what you're attracted to? Well, it must be possible. If the Bible commands it, I believe that if the Bible commands something, the implication is that it's possible for you to do it. God provides what He commands. So, one way or another, we've got to figure out how to do it. And when a man comes to me in marriage counseling and says, you know what? I got to tell you, I just don't love her anymore. My response to that is, okay, do you have any other sins you'd like to confess? As long as you're confessing sins? I mean, that's a sin. Now, if somebody does that in the spirit of confessing a sin, that's fine. But if usually it's not said in that kind of a spirit. Usually it's said in the kind of an attitude of, it's just bad luck. I don't know what happened. I had love. It floated away. I don't know where it went. It's just too bad. Like there's no culpability there. Listen, that's a sin. You don't love your wife. The Bible commands you to love your wife. You don't love your wife. That's a sin. Saying, I don't love my wife anymore, that's like saying, I just don't feed my kids anymore. Well, feed them. So how do you do it? How do you obey this command? How do you take delight in your wife? Women, ladies, don't feel too bad that we have to have instruction on how to be delighted in our wives. I know that might not strike you as the greatest thing in the world, but actually, God designed the human emotions to where you can't maintain an emotion every day for years and years and years. I mean, in our sinfulness, in our fallenness, we're not capable of doing that. It does require some effort to adjust our attitudes. But it is possible, and we can find the answer in Genesis. You may have guessed that. Genesis 2, if you want to look there. Genesis 2:23. The first step to taking delight in your wife, if you want to take delight in your wife, look at Genesis 2:23. It says, "And the man said, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She will be called woman, and she was taken out of the man." Before the fall, This is the only emotional response that we ever see between Adam and Eve. In that marriage, the only insight we get into their emotions towards each other is this verse. Adam's joy in seeing her, and when we studied this, we found that this is a very joyful statement in the way it comes out in Hebrew. It's a very excited statement he makes. What is the cause of that joy? I don't know if you ever daydreamed about what it was like when he first saw her the very first time. What that moment was like. When Adam first time saw Eve, what do you suppose impressed him the most? What do you suppose was it about her that was the most thrilling to him and the most exciting to him that he was the most struck with? You can tell what was most delightful to him and what he was most impressed with by what he said. You might have expected him to say, "Wow! You know, look how gorgeous she is." Or look at her figure, or listen to her voice, what a beautiful voice, or something like that. And I'm sure he was delighted in all that stuff. But if you look at what he says, the thing that was the most thrilling to him, the thing that he rejoiced the most in is, look what he says. He says, "At last, this is bone of my bone." You see, what God is showing us here is that the ideal in marriage is to experience joy. And get this, and to experience that joy, to derive that joy from the oneness of the relationship. This is bone of my bone. That's what got him excited. The intimacy, the oneness, the unity. How do you take delight in your wife? The first step is to work to achieve intimacy in the relationship. The more you achieve oneness and intimacy, the more ability you'll have to take delight in your wife. You'll be placing yourself in a position to do that. There are things about her that God designed to be delightful to you. But you won't be able to take joy in those things unless you're in a context of intimacy. So when you work to achieve closer and closer intimacy, you're placing yourself in a position to delight in your wife. You know, that's just kind of how you have to do things. If you want to take delight in something you're not already delighting in right now, you have to place yourself in a context to do that. Like some of you, if we put a backpack on your back right now and took you up on a backpack trip right now, you might hate it. And yet if you spent a year getting in shape and you hung around people that love backpacking and they could tell you, explain to you all the things that are good about backpacking and you got some real good equipment there, and then after that period, then you went backpacking, maybe then you would really love it. You have to place yourself in a context to be able to appreciate what's good about something. And it takes some effort. Shallow things can be instantly appreciated, but they only give shallow pleasure, momentary pleasure. Things that have much more to offer can't be instantaneously appreciated. They take some study, some effort. But the reward is much greater. And you can see that the way it works with art. And if you're going to... Another thing is, if you're going to take delight in your wife, it's going to require that you defer taking delight in some other things. If you're going to find pleasure in your wife, you're not going to be able to find pleasure in other things. Some of the other things, you know, if you spend your time ogling at the images on TV and movies and magazines of other women and so on, and you're taking delight in that, you're not going to be able to be delighted in your wife. You're just not going to be able to. And if that's the case in your situation, then you're just in direct disobedience to Proverbs chapter 6, which says, "Be intoxicated by your own wife's love, not by any other woman." Allowing yourself to be attracted to someone you live with every day requires that you make a concerted effort to think about her in ways that will be conducive to that. Think about her in the most positive light. And that takes some effort. It takes work. If you allow laziness to invade your marriage in this area, you will become bored with her, and that is sin. So, step number one is to restore intimacy. And if you want to know how do I restore intimacy, we did a whole message on that a couple of weeks ago on restoring intimacy. I'm not sure which sermon it was. Just listen to all of them and you'll get it. Anyway, step number two, the way that you learn to enjoy something. If it's something you don't enjoy now and you're trying to learn how to enjoy it, what you do is you focus your attention on the good things about that thing, right? I mean, the excellencies of that thing. And we talked about that with restoring intimacy with God. The way that you restore intimacy with God is you focus your attention on His excellencies. Well, it's the same way with your wife. People who can't stand classical music, they study and they learn about what's excellent about it, and then they spend time listening to it, putting through their minds the things that they learn that are excellent about it, then they will learn to appreciate it. It's something that is so excellent that it's not able to be immediately appreciated. It takes some education. And after that process, then they can learn to enjoy it. Same with your wife, men. Become a student of your wife. And by the way, that's a lifelong process. Some of you have been married a long time. Maybe you're thinking, you know what? I figured her out years ago. Well, guess what? She's not the same woman she was years ago. She's completely different now. Those things that you finally figured out that she really likes, she doesn't even like those things anymore, hardly. She likes other things now. This is a constant process because we always change. Be a connoisseur of your wife. Like someone who's a connoisseur of fine wine or something can tell you the subtle benefits of a certain flavor or whatever. Be able to be a connoisseur of your wife. Study your excellencies. Work on making a list of 50 wonderful things about your wife. And I mean a real list. Don't just sit and just think, oh, she's good at this, good at that. I'm talking about right on paper, 50 good things about your wife. And then focus your thoughts on those a large percentage of the time. And you know, she may not even mind if you share that list with her. Actually, you want to keep that list handy. It's good material for cards and stuff like that when you're writing notes to her or whatever. But focus your thoughts on her excellencies. All the things your wife wants from you. You know, the romance and the gentleness and the kindness and the thoughtfulness and all that. All that's going to be impossible if you don't really care for her. But do you remember when you first fell in love, when you know, and the emotions were strong? You didn't have to discipline yourself to do those things. You could hardly help but to do them. When you delight in your wife, the rest of your responsibility tends to come naturally and more easily. I mean, what do you think your wife wants more? A bunch of flowers and chocolates and cards and special events? Or a husband who's just crazy about her and who is obviously crazy about her? Which do you think would make her happier? To be able to say, well, my husband took me on a trip and he did this and he gave me this and he gave me a ring or whatever. Or my husband is intoxicated with my love and he delights in me more than any other earthly thing. What do you think she would prefer? So, number one, build intimacy in your relationship. Number two, focus on her excellencies. And number three, make her happy. This is simple. Just make her happy. Take delight in her by delighting in her delight. Did you get that? Take delight in her by delighting in her delight. Work to make her delighted. You know, it's not wrong to seek joy. It's not wrong to seek happiness. The question is, are you going to seek private happiness at her expense, or are you going to seek happiness in her happiness by making her happy? You can derive enjoyment from people two different ways. You can derive enjoyment from people at their expense, or you can derive enjoyment from people by bringing about their happiness. And that's to your advantage anyway. Frankly, it's much easier to take delight in someone who's smiling and happy, isn't it, than somebody who's grumpy. So you might as well make her happy just for your sake, right? It's easier to delight in a happy person. She's much more delightful when she's smiling, isn't she? So make her smile. Do special things for her. You know, women like special things. Do something to make her happy. Figure it out. Women like it when you're creative. Women like pleasant surprises. They like it if you plan the whole date instead of just coming and saying, what do you want to do? They like romantic gestures. They like your life. Your wife likes certain things. Find out what she likes. Now, I realize part of the problem we run into as men is it's impossible to be creative all the time. When you were dating, that only lasted a short time. You came up with some great ideas, but you can't keep that up for 20 years. I mean, you run out of ideas after a while. You give her flowers, you give her candy, you go on a date, what else is there? You know, and you think, I ran out of ideas. I mean, I can't spend my full time, courting my wife. I've got to work my job, and I've got to take care of the chores around the house and all this other stuff. So how do you do it? You got a problem. I mean, you have the goal of making your wife happy, but you've got some significant obstacles in that that's difficult to do. And if you're like most men, you might say, well, oh, you know, I've got an obstacle. I guess the thing to do is just to drop that goal and give up and never give it another thought. I can't be romantic all the time, every day. I'm just not creative enough, so forget it. So you're not romantic to her. You're justified in not being romantic to her because, after all, you thought about it for several minutes and you realize that there's an obstacle, so you're justified in just quitting, right? Do you approach that? I mean, is that the approach you take in any other area of life? Think about it. You do that at work. Your boss gives you some difficult project and you run into the very first obstacle. It's difficult. So you just drop it. Go home. You're working on taxes and you're figuring out and you come up and say, you don't understand this, I don't understand this. You just take it all and just throw it in the trash and walk away. Or you go golfing and you get a tough shot over water or something, say, I can't do this, pack up your clubs and drive home. No. I mean, every other area of life, you face a difficult obstacle and you just apply your problem-solving skills to figure out how to get around this obstacle and achieve your goal. You just figure out a way to succeed. Is your marriage not as important to you as your job or your taxes? Figure out a way to do it. Just figure out a way. Get some help. Buy a book. You know, there's a little book. I was going to bring it this morning. I forgot. I think it's in my case. It's called 101 Ways to Make Love to Your Wife with Your Clothes On. Or subtitled 101 Ways to Romance Your Wife. And there's a lot of great little examples in there. I just jotted down the first four or five here. You know, you just turn a page. It says, put a note on each of seven in each of seven balloons, listing some goodie or activity you know she would like, and let her pop one each day and get the surprise. You know, one each day. See, you wouldn't have thought of that. This guy thought of this stuff. He put it in a book. You can do that. Your wife's going to think you're incredibly creative. She doesn't have to know about the book. The next page says, when she's talking, just turn toward her and look her full in the face. Another day, it says, ask about her dreams. Just say, if time or money were no object, what would you enjoy doing? Just take her out to dinner and ask her that question. Another day, give her a foot massage. Another day, tape a note to the bathroom scale. It says, just right. That's good. Another day, arrange for a sleigh ride. Another day, next time you're in an empty elevator together, give her a big kiss on the lips just before the door opens. I mean, you know, each day there's just different things. And most of them are free. So there's ways to get around. The point that I'm saying is, I mean, you can think of something. You can make an effort. If this were an assignment at your job, you would make an effort. You would figure out a way to get it done. If you don't have enough money to make your mortgage payment, you sit down and one way or another, you figure out a way to get that mortgage payment paid, right? I mean, you think of something. If your cars aren't running, you sit down and you think of a way to get some transportation for your family. Well, if your wife isn't happy, you need to apply your abilities of problem solving and think of a way to succeed in making life wonderful for her. So, husbands, love your wives. Let's go back to Colossians 3. That's husbands, love your wives. And then it says, it goes on to say in verse 19, and do not be harsh with her. That's the second part. Do not be harsh. Be gentle. And it especially goes with the way you talk to her. Be polite. You know, I just think a huge percentage of marital problems would be instantaneously solved if the husband and the wife would just be polite in the way that they talk. You know, if you just talk to your spouse the way you talk to guests in your home, you wouldn't believe the difference it would make in your marriage. 1 Corinthians 13:5 says, love is not rude. Don't be rude. There are times, you know, when it's necessary for you to say something that's going to be hard for your wife to take. There are times when it may be necessary for you to say something that could hurt your wife. But there is never, ever, any time, ever, when it's necessary for you to be unkind to your wife in the way that you speak to her. Never. It may sound simplistic, but it can go a long way in repairing problems in your marriage if you just start saying please and thank you and you're welcome around the house. When a guest comes into your home, what do? You offer them a seat. You ask if they'd like something to drink. You tidy up the house before they arrive. You know, whatever. Just, you don't have to... If you want to treat your wife well, you don't have to go to a seminar for a weekend or read a book or know how to do that. Just pretend she's a guest in your home. Treat her like a guest. Because the more familiar we become with one another, the more we tend to take advantage of each other and not show love. Familiarity tends to breed contempt. It's really true. But it shouldn't be. I read this little thing this week called The 7 Years of the Married Cold. It's just a description of how a man responds to his wife's illnesses over the period of 7 years of marriage. Here's how it goes. First year, oh, sweetheart, you've got a bad sniffle. And there's no telling about these things with the strep going around. I'm putting you in the hospital for a general checkup and a good rest. I know the food's lousy, but I'll be bringing in your food from the Olive Garden. I've already got it arranged with the head nurse. Second year. Listen, darling, I don't like the sound of that cough. I'm taking you to the doctor and then putting you in bed for some rest. I'll take care of supper tonight. Third year. Maybe you better lie down, honey. Nothing like a little rest when you feel lousy. I'll bring you something. Where do you keep the soup and the can opener? Fourth year. Now look, dear, be sensible. After you finish the dishes and vacuuming and laundry and get the kids to bed, you better get some rest. Fifth year. Why don't you take some aspirin? And maybe you should run to the store and pick up some Kleenexes. You're using them all up. Sixth year. For Pete's sake, stop sneezing. You trying to give me pneumonia? And seventh year, if you just gargle or something instead of sitting around barking like a seal all evening, I can't even hear the TV. Familiarity breeds contempt, and it's a normal response for us to become less and less polite with somebody that we live with. But our home should be a place of peace and kindness and gentleness and courtesy. We should teach our kids to be polite in the way that they address one another, and we should as well. Peter makes the same point in 1 Peter 3 when he says, husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you in the gracious gift of life so that nothing will hinder your prayers. We need to be considerate and especially gentle with our wives because God has made her more emotionally fragile than you are. Now, some men have been irritated by that. They said, oh, she's so delicate, fragile. She's so easily hurt, bugs me. Listen, that's not a reason to be irritated at her. According to 1 Peter 3, that's a reason to hold her in higher honor. You say, why? Why? Why do I hold her in higher honor just because she's more delicate, more fragile, more easily hurt? The reason is because she's that way, get this, for your benefit. God made her to be your helper. And part of being your helper included companionship. Remember that? And it's the kind of companionship and comfort, encouragement, and strengthening that only a woman can give to a man. Another man can't provide it. God designed her in a special way to be an encouragement to you and an especially good companion to you. But in designing her that way, number one, it enabled her to be especially encouraging to you emotionally, more so than a man could be. But number two, also left her more vulnerable emotionally. Is she more delicate and fragile emotionally? Is she more easily hurt? Do the tears flow more readily and more frequent? Yes, but she's like that for your sake. So, with all she has to go through in life, being so vulnerable emotionally, and suffering far more emotional pain than you have to suffer in life, the least you could do is to be sensitive to her. And the least you could do is be considerate and gentle. You know another reason why she's more vulnerable? Is because she's required by God to be submissive to you. Do you understand what that's like? I mean, can you imagine? That gives you considerable power to mess up her life, doesn't it? You're the leader of the home, and she has to be submissive to that. And so as long as you're not leading her into sin, she has to follow even when you make foolish decisions. That gives her tremendous ability to really foul up her life. I mean, you can mess up her life emotionally. You can mess up her life financially and get her into all kinds of debt. You can mess up her life socially and 100 other ways. She's very vulnerable. Worst of all, you can mess up her life by not leading her towards Christ and jeopardize her eternal reward. That's how vulnerable she is. And she's that vulnerable by God's command for your benefit. Doesn't that just make you want to just do anything, even lay down your life in order to protect her? I mean, if you were working some construction site and it was a dangerous construction site and the big boss points to a guy and says and tells him to give his helmet to you so that you will be protected. And now he has to walk around without a helmet. And he willingly does that. He gives up his own helmet, puts it on your head. He's glad to do that. If he's willing to go around and be vulnerable and exposed like that, the least you could do is not go through and keep whacking him on the head all day long, right? If you take a nail and you scratch a man's arm with the nail, and then you take and make the identical scratch in a woman's arm, the woman will experience more of a sensation of pain than the man because she has more nerve endings in her skin. God has given her an advantage of having a superior sense of touch, and the drawback of that is a greater sensitivity to pain. God also gave her the advantage of greater emotional sensitivity. And that superior emotional sensitivity is a tremendous asset to the team. It's a great asset for carrying out the man's overall task as a team. You need that asset. But that very asset is what makes her vulnerable. You know, it's like a quarterback on the offense of a football team. You know, an offensive football team spends 75% of its energy just trying to protect the quarterback, who is the most important player, the only one who can advance it down the field by throwing the ball. But that very asset to the team is what makes him so vulnerable in a need of protection. Her assets are what make her vulnerable and in special need of protection and gentleness and sensitivity and consideration. There are all kinds of assets offered to the family by the woman, and they're the very things that make her vulnerable. You benefit from those assets. And if you fail to protect her, the whole team will tend to keep losing. Let me give you some advice. On Judgment Day, don't be standing too close to the guy who inflicted pain on his wife that wasn't absolutely necessary. You say, oh, she's tough. I mean, she can handle it. She's not like most women. She's tough as nails. Well, I don't know, maybe she is tough. The question isn't whether or not she can handle it. The question is whether or not she ought to have to handle it. She's tough? What kind of reasoning is that to hurt somebody? She's tough? What if you're walking down the street and the Golden Gloves champ walks by and looks at you and say, you know, he looks like he's tough. He looks like he can take a punch. Does that mean he should just pop you one in the face? So what if she, I mean, if someone's tough, that's no reason to hurt them. You're her protector. God made her vulnerable, placed her under your care, and it would be bad enough for if you just left her out in the cold, left her exposed to danger, didn't protect her, left her exposed to harm. That would be bad enough, but to be the one to inflict harm on her. Imagine what it would be like to be her, to have her protect her in life, be the one inflicting harm on her. You say, but she just does things that drive me crazy. I mean, I just hate it when she does this, and I can't stand the way she does that. And if I don't continually focus her attention on those weaknesses, she'll never fix them. Well, what weaknesses does your wife have that prevents you from delighting in her? What is wrong with your wife? What is lacking? Is there something lacking in the way she looks? Is there some personality problem she has? Is it a spiritual issue? Is there something wrong with her character? What is it? I mean, every human being has weak points. Your wife has weak points. What is it? What is it that's bad about her? Whatever it is, after learning all that we've learned about a man's role, would you dare spend even one moment more than is absolutely necessary thinking about her weaknesses? When you asked your wife to marry you, you were asking a lot of her. I mean, you were asking her to completely give herself to you, to completely open herself up to you, and let you into her life, and to see all that there is about her, warts and all. That's what you were asking her. In return, basically what you were telling her is, look, don't worry, you can trust me. If you open yourself completely to me, remove the fig leaves, let me all the way into your life, you can trust me. And so she did. She trusted you. And she took a huge risk. And she made herself incredibly vulnerable to you. And she handed over to you the keys. She placed in your hands the ability to hurt her more than any other human being in the world. She took a huge risk by letting another human being into her inner garden, to borrow a phrase from Song of Solomon. She took a huge risk letting another human being into her most private world with the understanding that you were trustworthy. So now are you going to focus all your attention and your thoughts on her weaknesses and violate that trust and humiliate her by staring at that which is most embarrassing to her? I mean, are you so cruel that you would announce to her your displeasure in her weaknesses? Are you so heartless that even though you're the only other human being in the whole world that she has allowed into her inner garden, once you're there, you would mock it and make fun of it and criticize it and tear it to shreds? Is that how Christ loved the church? Now, is there a place for helping one another to improve? Sure. I mean, Teresa and I do that. We do that twice a year. We have a planning retreat. We spend a night by ourselves away from the kids, and we go over and I say, how could I be a better husband? And she tells me things. And she says, how could I be a better wife? And we talk about it, and we set goals, and we have a certain plan to reach those goals. And 6 months later, we write it all down so we can check how we're doing, and it's a very helpful thing. But listen, The time to bring that stuff up is in a context like that. If you want to do that once every 6 months, once a month, or whatever you agree on, that's fine. But the time to bring that kind of stuff up is never right in the middle of a fight. The time to bring that kind of stuff up is never at the moment when you're irritated and agitated. The time to bring that stuff up is not every other day. None of that will help. It'll never help. All it'll do is hurt your spouse, nothing else. And if you doubt that, just ask, how much progress have you ever made from nagging your wife in the past? What good has it done up till now? It doesn't work. But if you both agree to set aside a time, you know, where you can talk about that stuff, then that's fine. But every other time, except for that specific time, criticism of each other should be completely out of bounds. Especially husbands toward the wives. Husbands, love your wives, and don't be harsh with them. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this picture that you've given us of Christ in the church. And the standard for us as men to love our wives like you loved us. Father, it's so far out of this universe, so far beyond anything we could. The way that you loved the church. Lord, help us to remember that when we're trying to decide what reasonable limits to set on how we are going to serve our wives. Help us to be gentle. Help us to be energetic in figuring out how to get past the obstacle of the difficulty of doing what's enjoyable to her. Maybe the things she appreciates are things that cost a lot of money and we don't have money. Maybe we have to figure a way to get around obstacles. Lord, help us to do it. Help us to have the renewed energy to try to do it and help us to succeed. All of us men, Father, just look to you right now and plead with you. Give us the ability to make life wonderful for our wives. Give us the energy to take delight, instead of taking delight in so many other things, to take delight in her delight, in making her happy. Help us to be gentle. Help us to be considerate. Help us to be good students of our wives. Help us to be servants, to wash their feet. We pray this for your sake and in your holy name. Amen.